This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. Before the Las Vegas Golden Knights took to home ice for Game 1 of the Stanley Cup Finals, the marketing geniuses behind the team got their chance to shine. First, they told us what the Golden Knights have been doing in the NHL playoffs this year. They've been
conquering enemies on land, sea, and air. The West belongs to Vegas.
All right, okay. Who's going to argue with a voice as authoritative as that one? Who's going to challenge that team?
The Capitals from the East attack our fortress.
Right. Washington has been showing up for the games, but do they really have any hope? After the extravagance of that promotion, it's fun to imagine what the Knights Stanley Cup rings would look like if they do win the Cup. But our first story isn't about Las Vegas at all. It's about another Stanley Cup final and another ring. Here's Only a Game's Gary Wallach.
Hector Cloutier is a former member of Canadian Parliament. He's advised Prime Minister Jean Chrétien and rubbed elbows with world leaders. Decades before that, he played hockey with his friends in the little villages that dot the banks of the Ottawa River, where it forms the border of Ontario and Quebec.
Pond hockey are the outdoor rinks up around Chapeau and Pembroke and Petawawa and Waltham and Sheenborough.
Cloutier says one player stood out. His name was Chris Hayes.
He was a great skater, a fantastic skater. He was solid. He was wiry. He was hard-nosed, and if you wanted to play a finesse game, he could play a finesse game. If you want to play a tough, rough game, he could play a tough, rough game. But he was always the star of the show.
Chris Hayes didn't follow Cloutier into the rough, tough world of politics. His career path would lead him into the company of even bigger celebrities, at least in Canada. When Hayes joined the Oshawa Generals in 1964, his roommate was a top prospect who'd soon begin an 18-year NHL career as a grinding corner man and a fearsome fighter.
So what was it like rooming with Wayne Cashman? Did the slightest argument provoke a major brawl?
Wayne was kind of rough around the edges and flexed his muscles a lot.
Also on the Generals roster was a young guy named Orr. Hayes remembers the future Hall of Famer this way.
Bobby was very quiet, very, very quiet.
Hayes posted good numbers at Oshawa. He became one of the few junior players of his era to earn a college degree. NHL scouts were interested. Hector Cloutier says Hayes' brains, hockey skills, and brawn endeared him to one team in particular.
Why do you think the Boston Bruins liked him?
Hayes joined the Bruins for training camp in the fall of 1971, but was sent down to the minors before the NHL season began. Hayes' CHL team was knocked out of the playoffs the following spring. He was pondering his summer plans when he got a call from Bruins head coach Tom Johnson, whose team was battling the St. Louis Blues in the Eastern Conference Finals.
Tom says, you're going to dress tonight, and I was ecstatic because I wanted to play some more hockey.
The word got out to Hector Cloutier in Petawawa.
Somebody called somebody, and so we were just phoning one another around, saying, you know, Hayes has been called up and he's playing with Boston tonight. It was a big event. It was a huge event because when does someone from a little Quebec town of population around 200 get an opportunity to play in the Stanley Cup playoffs with Bobby Orr, Phil Esposito, Cashman, Sanderson, Johnny Busick? So it was a very prestigious thing for him to play there. It was huge news.
On April 23rd, 1972, Chris Hayes suited up for Game 3 in St. Louis.
I know when they announced the lineup and his name was there, I mean, it just went, wow, like you're in the big leagues now.
Cloutier was listening on the family radio. The TV was unavailable.
I think my sisters were watching The Edge of Night or something.
Chris Hayes didn't expect to get much playing time in Game 3. He was a left winger, and the Bruins were stacked on the left side. To crack the lineup, he'd have to get the nod over the more experienced John Busick, Don Marcotte, Ace Bailey, and his old Oshawa roommate, Wayne Cashman. He worried that the veterans might not welcome him.
I knew all the guys from training camp. Cash was there, Bobby, Freddie Stanfield said, where you been so long? You know, what have you been doing? You know, I remember Cash saying before the game, they better bring their own puck because they're not going to get ours tonight.
Hayes doesn't remember much about the game. The box score shows Hayes with no goals or assists. He served a 2-minute penalty for too many men on the ice. But Hayes does remember replacing Wayne Cashman on the Bruins' top line, centered by Phil Esposito, then the league's leading scorer. Hayes recalls a 2-on-1 rush during which he drew a backpedaling defenseman away from Espo so he could get off a shot. Hayes returned to the bench.
Cash shouted, "Why didn't he yell for the puck?" And I said, "I forgot what his name was."
The Bruins won 7-2 and took a 3-games-to-none lead in the series. Chris Hayes and the Bruins were one win away from the Stanley Cup Finals, but...
Yeah, well, Tom Johnson talked to me after the game, and he said, "Chris, I got to talk to you." And he says, "You're not going to like what I'm going to tell you, but Chris, you know you can play in this league, but..."
Hayes trails off. He's at a loss to explain why he was let go. He thinks the Bruins wanted to promote players from its AHL affiliate, the Boston Braves. Whatever the reason, the Bruins didn't need him anymore. They swept the Blues, and in the Stanley Cup Finals, they had a fairly easy time with the New York Rangers.
It's over! The Bruins have won the Stanley Cup!
Hayes said he didn't watch. He's stoic when asked if he was bitter about being left off the roster as the Bruins captured their second cup in 3 seasons.
That's just the way the cards were dealt, and I just accepted it.
Cloutier thinks that if Hayes had signed with any other NHL team, he would have enjoyed a long, successful pro hockey career. Instead, Hayes played the next season with the AHL's Boston Braves, and then another with the CHL's Albuquerque Six Guns. 2 years after his one and only NHL game, his doubts were beginning to catch up with him.
And I went home that summer, and I turned 28 in August. I had a good education, I had my MBA, I had a young family. I was probably more apt to get into the corporate world in my late 20s than my early 30s, so I made a decision to end my professional hockey career.
Hayes started looking for a job in the banking industry.
I was in Ottawa at the time, and I was just walking down Bank Street, and I saw a sign we were hiring or something like that, and they hired me right on the spot. It was kind of an adjustment after making X amount of dollars to making about a third of an X amount of dollars, but it worked out in the long run.
Did you ever find yourself sort of drifting off into a daydream thinking, gosh, I sure would love to have a championship ring from the Bruins?
You know, I did think about it, but I wasn't focused on it. And to be honest with you, back then I didn't even know if I was eligible for a ring.
But Hector Cloutier knew.
The criteria for getting a Stanley Cup ring is simply this. If you have dressed and played in one game in the Stanley Cup playoffs, you are eligible to get a Stanley Cup ring. I'd thought about it for years and years and years, and it had always been bothering me. And early last fall or late last summer, I don't know, something just popped in my head and said, you know what? Chris Hayes should get that ring, and I'm going to see if I can help facilitate getting the ring.
Cloutier's career in politics taught him a few things about string pulling and diplomacy. He sent a handwritten letter to the owner of the Boston Bruins.
And I just laid it out there, and I didn't have the sword of Damocles hanging over his head. No, I just tugged at his heartstrings a bit and said, you know, Mr. Jacobs, this has been an oversight for 45 years now, and isn't it time that this oversight was resolved? What do you think? And I left it like that, and I never explained to Jeremy Jacobs that I was a former member of parliament or a former advisor to prime minister. That didn't even come into the letter in any way, shape, or form. Within a week, Cam Neely called me.
Cam Neely is a Hall of Fame hockey player. He's currently the president of the Boston Bruins.
He said, okay. He said, I've been speaking to Johnny Busick. He remembers Chris very well.
Busick was a Bruin for 21 seasons. He's now a senior advisor with the team. But he hadn't known that Hayes had never received a ring. Nobody in the organization knew. A few months after receiving Cloutier's letter, Jeremy Jacobs gave the green light. The Bruins found a jeweler who could make an exact replica. 17 diamonds in a thick gold setting, bearing the words, Boston Bruins, World Champions. Now all they needed was Hayes' ring size.
So then I phoned Chris, and Chris thought at first I was joking. He said, "You're kidding me, aren't you, Hector?" I said, "No, I'm not kidding. I need your ring size and the mailing address because they're going to courier that ring up to you." He said, "Really?" And I said, "Yes."
The ring arrived, special delivery, at Chris Hayes' home in Chapeau on the morning of March 27th, 2018.
I went to the fireplace and my wife's picture was there.
Hayes' wife, Joanne, died 7 years ago.
So I got her picture and I put it on the dining room table and I said, "Honey, we're going to do this together." And I just opened it up and, I mean, it was magnificent. For about 2 or 3 days, it felt like I was in the best movie that was ever made in the world. Like, is this happening, you know? Sometimes I thought it was a dream, to be honest. And then I'd look at the ring and I'd say, "Oh, well, I guess it did happen." I find myself just looking at it. Like, I sit out at night sometimes and on the veranda and sort of look at it. And it'll bring back so many memories of not just hockey players I met along the way, but people I've lived with. People I've met, there's a different thought every time I look at the ring because something new comes into my mind.
Hector Cloutier is happy his longtime friend got his Stanley Cup ring. He knows a few folks might think he doesn't deserve it.
Some people say he played one game. I said, "So they play in the Super Bowl one game too and they get a Super Bowl ring."
And for those familiar with NHL protocol, there's an unanswered question. Shouldn't a player who earned a championship ring also have his name engraved on the Stanley Cup? I suggest to Hector Cloutier that this, too, should be rectified.
Perhaps the wheels are already in motion. I'm not trying to be evasive, but there has been an inquiry made. Put it that way.
Mr. Cloutier, we look forward to learning about the results of that inquiry. Our story was produced and reported by Only a Game's Gary Wallach. Long before the Golden Knights, Las Vegas had the Gamblers, and the city's first hockey team offered a special welcome to its opponents.
Get them drunk and tell them, "Hey, take it easy on us. We don't have, you know, a whole lot here." And by the time they woke up, they were behind 5-1.
That's coming up on Only a Game from NPR.
How much would you pay to avoid morning traffic? Why are plane tickets to Boise so expensive? I'm Cardiff Garcia, co-host of The Indicator. In every episode, we take on a new, unexpected idea to help you make sense of the day's news. Listen every afternoon on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Bill Littlefield, and it's time for three stories you should know.
James fires a three. That's good. LeBron James from way downtown. And they've tied
the Golden State Warriors took game one of the NBA Finals, but Cleveland Cavalier LeBron James once again established that he's very good at basketball. He scored 51 points, and that's where we're going to start this week. I'm joined by the Ringer's Claire McNear and the Boston Globe's Nora Princiotti. Welcome back to both of you.
Thank you so much. Great to be here.
Thank you, Bill. Hello.
Nora, your turn to go first.
So, I want to talk about LeBron for a second. As you mentioned, dropped 51 points in game one of the finals. First time that's happened in a finals game where the team that has the player doing that has lost. So I was in Cleveland for a while during the Eastern Conference Finals because of the Celtics. And in a very lowly football writer parachuting in, not knowing the team for a week kind of way, my major takeaway from that is that the Cavs have the weirdest vibe. You know, it's really hard to play with a superstar because inevitably, as we saw with J.R. Smith making that blunder, not understanding what the score was at the end of the game in game one, the other Cavaliers, whether it's being mocked on Saturday Night Live or just never being able to live up to LeBron's caliber of play, they shoulder the blame in a loss, perhaps deservedly so. It's hard to be a general manager when you have a superstar on a series of one-year contracts. And it's even hard to be an owner being asked to spend all this money and not knowing if your guy is going to stay or if he's going to go. I mean, I think a lot of people think that this is, again, LeBron's last year in Cleveland. And I just think that's fascinating because, you know, you wouldn't think of that as a bad thing. And of course it isn't. They're in their fourth straight finals.
That you mean having the greatest player in basketball is a bad thing? Yes.
Right. You should be jumping for joy, right? But then you start to think about it. What if you are J.R. Smith? Nothing you do is really ever going to be good enough.
Claire, do you buy this other side to the coin?
Yeah, I mean, you know, I cannot speak for Cleveland fans, but I get the sense that they are grateful for him, but it is sort of this weird place to be in. And it's a strange thing where with LeBron, you know, his just being on a team generally has the aura of that team immediately being kind of an automatic contender. And it didn't feel like that this year. Of course, the Cavaliers are now in the finals and just about took game one from the Warriors this week. But it is a very strange dynamic. I think maybe it is both exacerbated and eased by the sense that I think everybody has kind of felt like this is his last year in Cleveland. And if it hasn't been an explicit swan song, it's kind of felt that way. So, yeah, it's a strange time.
He came back to Cleveland. He gave them that one championship.
Right.
And so maybe now they're thinking, well, we don't want to get too excited because he's probably going to go somewhere else. And yet they're in the finals and maybe we should get excited. And it's like they don't quite know what to do.
There's this weird sort of apathy among the fans. The first thing I noticed was that they were all talking about the Browns. The 0-16
Browns. And weeping
Browns.
Openly?
No. The 0-16 Browns were genuinely the talk of the town when I got there during the Eastern Conference Finals. And what people said when I asked them sort of incredulously, you know, they were 0-16 and you have arguably the greatest basketball player of all time, right? What? Talk about him. Care about him. The answer a lot of the time was, yeah, but the Browns, ironically, since they left Cleveland at one point, they're not going anywhere.
Claire, you have also recently returned from a sporting event. Explain, please.
I sure have. This week was the most important sporting event of all here in Washington, D.C. Not the Stanley Cup, but the National Spelling Bee was this week here in D.C. You know, we now have a new spelling champion. It's 14-year-old Kartik Namani from McKinney, Texas. This was also the 25th year that ESPN has aired the National Spelling Bee Finals live. The Bee was in prime time this year, as it is most years. And while it was up against Game 1 of the NBA Finals this year, the Spelling Bee usually gets somewhere north of a million viewers, which is pretty amazing. So my argument is that the National Spelling Bee isn't just a sporting event. It is the best sporting event.
Hmm.
And my rationale for that is, you know, I talked a little bit to Kartik's dad after he won, and he was telling me that his son trains something like 4 to 6 hours a day, every day, even on school days. It's 1 hour in the morning before school. He comes home, he does his homework, and then it's however many hours after that. And as a viewer of the Bee, you get to enjoy the event unvarnished, not like with most sports. You know, most of the kids are newcomers in the most literal sense possible. They are new to the stage. They are new to the world. And you can cheer for anyone and you'll be happy for whoever wins. And it's just as breathtaking, I would say, as the NBA. You know, it's similarly prodigious talents not available to mere mortals.
You know, I do think that that sort of raw emotion of these kids, it is sports, right? I mean, now I will say I watched the NBA Finals. I have to admit that that was the game that I chose to partake in as a viewer. But here's what I'm curious about. When you say that he trains, is that studying etymology? Is that rapid fire quizzing? Spell this word, spell that word? Because that's fascinating to me.
I think it's a little bit of all those things. I mean, it's standing in front of a whiteboard and writing down the words. It's, you know, going, oh, he has a trainer. He's got a woman who comes and helps him prep for this every single day, and his parents help him. And so, yeah, it's studying the etymology. I mean, the first thing these kids ask when they hear a word is, what language is that derived from? And you've got to think at this point, most of the kids on stage who averaged like 11 years old know, you know,
awesome.
Basic Greek, basic Latin, basic German. It's truly outstanding.
I have nightmares about spelling still because I've always been very bad at it. And in fact, I can still remember teachers writing notes to my parents saying, Billy had a fine year, but we can't teach him to spell.
Well, this radio thing makes a little more sense now.
Where were those trainers? Back in the late 50s when I needed them.
You know, I wonder if there's been any, it seems like they're spelling it at just a high, as high a caliber as ever, which is interesting because this is something that my dad always gripes about. He always says, kids aren't going to be able to know how to spell anymore because of all the autocorrect and spell check.
Absolutely. And, you know, most of these words are so obscure that they don't even show up in spell check. So.
Totally.
Claire, I just want to ask you one question to close off this topic. Are you willing to deal with all of the emails and tweets that say this show is nuts to contend that the Spelling Bee is the very best sporting event of all?
I would be proud.
I will send them your way. Today, I'm saluting Laurent Duvernay-Tardif. He's an offensive guard for the Kansas City Chiefs who graduated from medical school on Tuesday. This guy is not one of those rare players who goes back to school and gets an advanced degree once his career in the NFL is over. He got through medical school at McGill University while still playing in the NFL, and now he says he wants the back of his jersey to read either Dr. Duvernay-Tardif or Duvernay-Tardif, MD. And if the NFL doesn't go along with this, the league's even crazier than I think it is. So what do you think? Does the commissioner of the No Fun League bend on this one, Nora?
Oh, they have to. I'll be so disappointed if they don't. I mean, various suffixes are fine. I don't see any reason why they shouldn't let him do it. And I would go one step further. I hope when he tapes the introductions for the primetime games, please, I want to be hearing Dr. Duvernay-Tardif, MD. I hope he goes just as
both,
long.
Both
yes,
doctor and
both,
MD.
As drawn out as he can do it.
It's a far cry from he hate me, but you know, I'd still want to see it. Claire, what do you think? Does the NFL go along with this idea for the doc?
You know, I was originally inclined to say no, to be totally honest. I think that, you know, junior and senior are different. They are, you know, more explicitly part of the name and not a title. But I've kind of changed my mind in that the NFL and the Players Association have really been making a concerted effort to sort of facilitate players building other careers for when their playing days are through. And I think that, you know, if you can get a medical degree or a PhD before or while you're playing, I mean, heck, we should all celebrate that, especially the NFL.
I hope they do. I really do. And I will be watching the news to see if it happens. Since nobody else has mentioned it, I also do wonder how somebody who has an MD can think it's a good idea to keep playing pro football given what we know about CTE. But that is the doctor's call. It's his head. And good on him and good luck, right?
Sure.
My guests for this week's edition of Three Stories You Should Know have been The Ringer's Claire McNear and the Boston Globe's Nora Princiotti. Thank you, both of you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
I'd like to thank Fizook for leaving a review of Only a Game on Apple Podcasts. Fizook's review was titled, "That's Bill Little Goat to you, Buster." Thanks. That's good, right? Fizook also says, "Please say hi to C. Pizzle." That's Charlie Pierce for all you noobs. He, too, is chiller. And I'll let him know. Thanks to everyone who's left a review of Only a Game on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. It really does help other listeners to find our show.
The Golden Knight's army has vanquished the kings.
I couldn't resist. I just had to bring back the voice of the pregame show for the Las Vegas Golden Knights.
The West belongs to Vegas.
Not only have the Knights reached the Stanley Cup Finals in their first season, they've made ice hockey a hit in the middle of the desert. But turns out the Golden Knights didn't do all that in a vacuum. Only a Game's Martin Kessler has the story about some true Las Vegas hockey pioneers.
2 years ago, when the NHL announced that Las Vegas was getting an expansion team, plenty of locals were skeptical.
There was some people that thought the casinos don't like competition.
That's Brian Bulmer, a Vegas resident of nearly 50 years. Bulmer heard others say that the team would have to rely too heavily on tourists.
That the locals couldn't fill it up.
But Bulmer was optimistic.
I knew there was people in this town that loved the game.
Bulmer didn't just have a feeling about that. He knew it. Because 5 decades ago, Brian Bulmer played for the first pro hockey team to call Las Vegas home. The team was called the Las Vegas Gamblers, and they paved the way for the Golden Knights. The story of hockey in Las Vegas really starts with an ice rink. It was called the Ice Palace, and it was built in the late 60s in a strip mall a few blocks from the Sahara Hotel and Casino.
And the rink, as I was told, was built by the Teamsters Union, or with Teamsters Union money.
If you've seen the movie Casino with Robert De Niro and Joe Pesci, you know why that's noteworthy.
These are the guys who secretly control Las Vegas.
Mama got dancing again.
Because they control the Teamsters Union. And that's where you had to go if you wanted to borrow money to buy a casino.
Jimmy Hoffa, the head of the Teamsters Union in the late 50s, he was tied to organized crime. I mean, there's really no dispute about that.
This is Jeff Schumacher with the Mob Museum in Las Vegas.
They sort of came up with this scheme for the Teamsters Union pension fund to be used to hand out loans for construction of casinos and other things in Las Vegas.
We can't say for sure whether the mob had anything to do with the Teamsters loaning money to build an ice rink in the middle of the desert, but Bulmer offers this.
All I can say about that is we were told that the rink was built with money enough to have individual seating, but when it actually was built, it was just bare aluminum benches. So that money went somewhere. I don't know where, but that's just part of the history of this town.
So the Ice Palace didn't have individual seats, but it did have a bar overlooking the ice and a regulation-sized rink. And that was good enough to support the Las Vegas Gamblers. The team formed in 1968 and started playing teams from LA, Salt Lake, and other nearby cities. The Gamblers had an eclectic roster. They had school teachers and bartenders, blackjack and craps dealers. There was a guy who sold booze to the 600-plus bars in town, and eventually an FBI agent who'd come to practices when he wasn't catching bank robbers. But there were a couple of challenges for a hockey team trying to attract a crowd in Las Vegas in the late 60s. First off, there was lots of competition for people's attention.
That's when Elvis Presley was the premier performer in Las Vegas. This is the older, heavier Elvis Presley. And he was playing at the International. And then down the street, you had Liberace. Liberace was playing to huge crowds, and then you had Tom Jones. And he was selling out showrooms.
And then there was the fact that it was ice hockey in Las Vegas. Did the average people in town seem to know that much about hockey when you first showed up there?
Well, no, they had no idea.
That's Don Woodbury, another former gambler. In 1968, Woodbury was transferred to Las Vegas for his job with Firestone Tires. He'd grown up playing junior hockey in the Ottawa Auditorium, which held 7,000 fans and was built for the sport. As for the Las Vegas Ice Palace?
This wasn't. I mean, I think hockey was an afterthought.
Woodbury says the Ice Palace only had room for a couple thousand fans. That first season, only a few hundred would show up for games. In the Gambler's Game program, there was a section called Know Your Hockey, which explained the rules. But the Gamblers did have a couple things going for them from the start. First off, with so many young transplants from Canada and the Midwest living in town, the team was drawing guys who'd grown up playing high-level youth hockey. And then there was this. Was it hard for you guys to ever get teams to come visit and play you guys?
No. Not at all.
They loved to play us.
Teams wanted to come here all the time. As soon as they found out it was available, we could pick and choose.
Teams from the Midwest and beyond started coming to Vegas to play on Friday and Saturday nights. But usually, opponents would get to town on Thursday.
We'd have a party when they arrived at the hotel. I was going to say no drinking, but you know I was lying.
Oh yeah, get them drunk.
This is Bill Brisky, the booze salesman slash defenseman on the Gamblers roster.
Get them drunk and tell them, hey, take it easy on us. We don't have, you know, a whole lot here. And by the time they woke up, they were behind 5-1.
We usually won that first game. We usually did. So I have to say that Brisky's a pretty smart fella.
They thought they were coming out. They were going to do some gambling and drinking, a regular junket. You know, it was a holiday for them, right? But they would get beat and they'd say, oh, God, you guys are really good.
So the Gamblers won a lot, and they started drawing bigger crowds.
And it just kind of snowballed.
Sometimes fans would watch practices. A busload would follow the team to games in Fresno or Reno. And when the Gamblers played at home, there was a tradition for the players and fans after every game.
We'd go upstairs and party with them.
Brisky says the bar above the rink would be so packed after games you could barely move. Fans would buy the players drinks, and they'd talk about the game. And it wasn't just limited to the bar at the Ice Palace.
Any place we went, we'd bring fans with us.
I'm not surprised that the people loved you guys if you took them out.
Oh, we had a good time, yeah. Everybody had a good time.
But while the fans were having a good time, something else was going on.
Did you notice that over time, the crowds became more knowledgeable about the sport?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely, that happened. They knew what was going on. They knew what should be going on. Icing, offside, the penalties. When they thought there was a penalty should be called, they let the refs know.
Don Woodbury still remembers one fan, a local chef who'd catch his eye every game and give him a thumbs up or a thumbs down, depending on how he felt Woodbury had been playing. On at least one occasion, a gambler's fan tried to fight an opposing player. So a hockey culture was developing in Las Vegas. But drawing fans wasn't the only way the gamblers brought the sport to the city.
We taught so many kids how to skate.
We'd get a folding chair out there and let them push it around the ice.
I love the image of you guys as these, you know, high-level hockey players. In most other towns, if you guys were coaching youth players, it would probably be the cream of the crop. But here you guys are in Las Vegas, literally teaching little kids how to skate.
That's exactly it, and it was a lot of fun.
It was more like a community type then. And their parents would be in there, and that would help our thing too, you know, get the parents and the kids interested in our game.
Brian Bulmer estimates that over the years, he and his teammates taught a few hundred kids in Las Vegas how to skate. Then in the early 70s, a casino owner named Ralph Engelstead took control of the team in Vegas. Instead of the gamblers, they became the Las Vegas Outlaws.
And Ralph had a little bit of money, so that's kind of when the hockey started to take off in caliber.
The Outlaws hosted the 1972 U.S. Olympic team, as well as top squads from Europe.
We were really starting to build something.
But like lots of attractions in Las Vegas, the hockey team was hot for a couple years, and then it was on the outs. The Outlaws folded after the 74-75 season. There are a couple of possible explanations. Brisky says the team got in trouble on an overseas trip. There may have been too much trash talk against the Russians and too many fights in Germany. Bulmer says the owner of the rink and the owner of the team couldn't come to an agreement.
The rink wasn't available to us anymore, and Ralph Engelstad actually started to build his own rink, but it never turned out, and hockey just died right there.
But even though the team stopped playing, there were still all those adults in town who'd come to love the sport. And all those kids who'd learned to skate.
I would love to think that some of those people are part of what's out there watching the Golden Knights now. And I hope we left a little bit of enjoyment that helped to build with this.
Brian Bulmer and Bill Brisky still live in Las Vegas. Don Woodbury now follows the Golden Knights from L.A. And even though he left Las Vegas decades ago, he loves talking about his time with the gamblers.
I'm telling you, I get so excited. I can't believe it. I can't believe I'm doing this. I'm having more fun than you are. You don't know, Don. I'm stoked right now.
I told Don Woodbury that that was saying something, because I loved hearing about Las Vegas's true hockey pioneers. But it did make me sad to learn that some of the former gamblers hadn't made it to a Golden Knights game. Brisky told me the tickets were too expensive.
I think the Golden Knights should honor you guys, should have you guys all come for a game.
You know, thank you. That would be really great. Just introduce us at one. The original Las Vegas Gamblers. I still have my shirt. And we're all getting old, so if you've got anything to do with it, tell them they better hurry.
I know a guy who knows a guy. I'll give him a call. That story was produced and reported by only a game's Martin Kessler. From the age of 12, surfer Joey Baran wanted to win the Pipeline Masters. At the age of 24, he finally did, but it wasn't the triumph he was expecting.
I literally was standing on the beach in pouring rain with my three surfboards by myself, and the thought was so clear and so profound in my mind, this is it? There's got to be more than this.
That's just ahead on Only a Game, and you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game NPR.
Planet Money tip number 17. A great analogy doesn't have to make sense.
Busier than a one-legged bobcat covering up his own crap on a frozen pond.
Did you just make that up?
Well, yeah.
Planet Money, a poetic podcast about the economy.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up next week on Only a Game, the guy who would have been coaching the U.S. Men's World Cup team if they hadn't lost to Trinidad Tobago. And you're over that, right? Because I am, for sure. But right now, it's time for my conversation with Charlie Pierce about the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill. And let's face facts. They had to play Trinidad and Tobago on the same day.
It's an old joke, but a good one. No question.
Thank you. Humor cops.
The Golden State Warriors took game one of the NBA Finals on Thursday night. Wild game featured a career-high 51 playoff points from LeBron, some weird calls, and a very bizarre decision, if that's the right word, at the end of regulation by J.R. Smith of the Cavs. What did you make of game one?
This was the one they could steal, and they didn't steal it. Through a combination of incredibly awful officiating and a move by J.R. Smith that is incomprehensible if you've played basketball for 11 seconds in your life. Seriously, he thought his team was ahead. And behaved accordingly down the stretch and gave us a great photo of LeBron James looking at him and gesticulating in a way that's not unfamiliar to parents who are saying, why didn't you think of that before we left?
The Cavs and the Warriors have now met in four consecutive finals. Charlie, Kevin Durant of the Warriors had something to say to people who were tired of the matchup. It went something like this. It may not be as suspenseful as a lot of people want it to be, but that's why you've got movies and music. Has he got that right?
Well, I don't know how suspenseful music is. I guess it can be if you've, you know, a song, if you've never heard it before, it can be suspenseful. But look, if there was a way to avoid this terrible disaster, and that was to have the Celtics and Houston win seven games at home.
The Stanley Cup Finals were tied at a game apiece going into the weekend. That might have been otherwise had Washington Capitals goalie Braden Holtby not made an amazing save in the second game. I assume you saw that.
I did, and it's the goalie equivalent of, you know, your hockey coach will tell you if you have the puck and you don't have any other options, just put the puck on net and hope for a bounce. This was Braden Holtby's equivalent of that, which is basically, oh my God, I have to make myself as big as possible. And he just, you know, he threw the stick out there and the guy shot the puck right into the paddle of his stick, but he was remarkably flexible in doing so.
The Vegas Golden Knights ceremony before game one included various pyrotechnics, performances by Lil Jon and Michael Buffer, and I don't know who they are, but I assume fans in Vegas did, and it was all terrific, right?
Well, Lil Jon's a rapper, and Michael Buffer is the Let's Get Ready to Rumble guy. Hey, listen, if you don't think the NHL has needed catapults, I don't know what to say to you. I mean, a lot of the old hockey guys are having conniption fits about this, but I have always thought that the Vegas quote-unquote game presentation was adorable.
NFL lawyers want a federal judge to appoint a special investigator to look into alleged fraud connected to concussion settlement claims. They allege that doctors, lawyers, and players, plural, have made fraudulent claims. Judge Anita Brody said that only one of the flagged claims was from a player.
Hmm. Does that mean that there are profiteering lawyers involved here?
This is hard to believe.
I am shocked to learn that. Yeah, this is unfortunate because this, first of all, it was bound to happen with the amount of money that's being slung around, that there were going to be some, you know, parasites. And it will diminish, of course, the importance of the story, and the NFL will use anything to cover its complicity in this.
You know, the saddest thing about this story to me is that time passes, and some of these guys really need the money now.
Yeah, and that's what's going to be affected.
Several NFL owners said in depositions this week that President Donald Trump's position on players kneeling during the national anthem did factor into their decision to impose the new policy on the players. I wonder if they said that proudly or admitted it sheepishly.
I think they admitted it proudly. because one thing, they're not as sheepish. This is going to bring enormous interest to every pregame for the next couple of seasons. Once again, I don't understand what everybody is so afraid of. The NFL owners have enough problems right now with the future of their sport than to worry about whether or not the various supporters of our current president are going to be angry at them.
Finally, Charlie, we have a pair of feel-good stories involving NFL players and airports. In the first, Arizona Cardinals tight end Jermaine Gresham paid a $50 baggage fee so a woman could make her flight. And in the second, Packers running back Aaron Jones stepped in when an airline failed to provide somebody to help a woman in a wheelchair collect her baggage and get to where she needed to go. And I don't want to believe that this is all part of some elaborate NFL public relations scheme. I want to believe these guys just did nice things. Are we okay with that?
Yeah, especially Aaron Jones. There's a great photo of him, by the way, pushing the woman. you know, with his backpack on, his giant man pushing the wheelchair. Yeah, these are both good things. Anyone who's put up with the insane regulations on baggages at airports in recent years has to love the Jermaine Gresham story, too, because he just stepped in and essentially took his credit card out and put it on a card.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce in Sports Illustrated from time to time. And, of course, he joins me every week here on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
Joey Brand's not a kid anymore. In fact, he's a grandfather. But sometimes the old nicknames, they die hard.
Even at the age of 57, there's people that see me and they go, "Hey, it's the California Kid."
Jim McKay called him that when he covered Joey Brand for Wide World of Sports in 1978. Brand has embraced the nickname. As a teenager, Brand became enamored of the surfing competition called the Pipeline Masters. It featured the best competitors and the most spectacular waves. For surfers, it was a very big deal at a time when there weren't so many big deals.
I remember in junior high telling my teachers that I was going to be a pro surfer. At that time, there was no pro tour. The pro tour started in 1976, and even then, it was very sketchy.
The first time Brand won a surfing contest in 1978, his first place check for $3,000 bounced, which must have been disappointing.
Actually, it worked together for good for me because I got a lot of coverage from it because that was a storyline. Young pro surfer wins first contest, check bounces.
The check was phony, but the win was the real thing, and it was the beginning of the California Kid's opportunity to range well beyond California.
I mean, I did the world tour. I traveled to South Africa, Brazil, and Japan and these different places. But my goal was always to win the Pipe Masters. The Pipeline Masters is the Wimbledon of surfing. It is the Masters in golf, the green jacket. That's what it is in the sport of surfing.
According to Joey Brand, part of the charm of the Pipeline Masters is that everybody who cares about surfing is watching. But the real draw is the type of waves in that competition.
It's what we call a barrel or a tube. It's hollow. And so the objective is to get deep in that barrel and to get spit out like a cannon. Either you make it or you get detonated.
This wouldn't be much of a story if all Joey Brand did was dream about those waves, would it? No. At 24, after 6 years as a pro surfer, Brand tore it up at the 1984 Pipeline Masters. He won. Watch the video sometime. It's not hard to understand how those waves could thunder through a teenage surfer's dreams. Brand had announced that after the tournament he would leave competitive surfing. Maybe he was that sure he'd win. He figured December 17th, 1984 would be the most dramatic and triumphant day of his life. And for a few minutes after the trophy presentation, maybe it was. But then,
all of a sudden it started pouring rain. Like within 5 minutes, it was heavy, heavy monsoonal type of rain. So everyone left. And literally within 15 minutes of being crowned the king of the surf world, I literally was standing on the beach in pouring rain with my three surfboards by myself. And the thought was so clear and so profound in my mind, this is it? Like, this is my life? There's got to be more than this.
For a while, there really wasn't. Brand organized some surfing tournaments. He returned to the Pipeline Masters a year later. Brand made the semifinals. But he felt as if his life had peaked and maybe it should end.
It's a dark place. And if you've never been there, it's hard to understand. And I've been there.
The depression became more serious, the despair more intense.
I just could not find a clear purpose to live.
In 1986, Joey Brand tried to kill himself with a drug overdose.
I tell people, I know how low you can go because I've been strapped into a straitjacket in a hospital and have the doctors talk to me like there's something wrong with me, which usually if you try and take your life, that's how they talk to you.
As Joey Brand tells the story, it wasn't what the doctors had to say that turned him around. He does recall one of them, perhaps it was a psychiatrist, telling him he needed to forgive himself. As he walked away from that meeting, Brand realized he didn't see it that way.
I do not believe I have the authority to forgive myself. I believe that authority belongs to God. And from that point in time on, I began to read the Bible and listen to Christian radio. And eventually, about 6 months later, I gave my life to Jesus Christ.
Brand found satisfaction in ministering to youngsters, telling them to stay away from drugs and obey mom and dad, but he was always introduced to those groups of kids as the former Pipeline Masters champ who'd become an evangelical Christian. He helped to start churches in Virginia and in Vermont. but he returned to the Pipeline Masters as a competitor a couple of times in the 90s, and then one day in 2007...
I've pastored a church here in Orange County, which I've been in ministry for 30 years. That morning, it came upon my mind that a door was going to open up to me in the surf industry again. It just is spending time, what we call devotional time, that thought crossed my mind, like, wow, you know, I'd be crazy if something opened up with surfing. I got to the church office, and there was a phone message from the great coach, Mike Parsons, who is also a great surfer. And he said, hey, Joey, it's me, Mike. We want you to consider being the head coach of the USA Surf Team.
When Brand accepted the offer to coach team surfing, he had a plan.
You know, I tended the flock. They just happened to be the best surfers in the United States under 18, and I had a great relationship with all of them.
That relationship lasted for 2 years, during which the favored U.S. team won medals that weren't gold. Maybe that's why the relationship ended, though Joey Brand says his departure from the U.S. team coincided with his desire to spend more time with his own children. But surfing was still a calling card. Brand made a film featuring his exploits, and everywhere he took it, he found opportunities.
And when I went to England in 2010, the British Surfing Association was like, oh my goodness, Joey Brand, you know, the coach, the U.S. team, you know, he's here. We should get him to work with our kids.
He recalls with a smile carrying the Union Jack at the World Championships in 2011. He'd always competed in a wetsuit featuring an American flag. A year later, the Brits decided their team should have a British coach. Eventually, Brand came to see that decision as just another opportunity in Chile.
I spent 3 years going back and forth to Chile to help build their program in surfing. And again, marching in parades with Chile. You know, when you're marching through a parade saying, C-H-E, L-E-A, G-G-G, L-L-L-A, it's very different than people chanting USA, USA.
The difference was also evident on the scoreboard. Despite Joey Brand's encouragement, the Chileans usually came in last.
You know, it was very enjoyable. It was so different than coaching USA Surf Team, where anything less than gold is failure.
The pressure of those expectations must not have put off Coach Brand. At the beginning of 2017, USA Surfing called again, and Brand came back. I wondered if when he returned, he still regarded the young surfers as a flock he'd tend.
I approach it this way. If I work for Starbucks, I'm not there to be a pastor. I'm there to make lattes, and that's what I'm going to do. But in doing that, I'm still true to my character and who I am. I stood alone on the beach as a Pipe Masters champion with the Lord, and I stand alone with the Lord in every situation I'm in. But I'm not hired by Starbucks to be a preacher. So my job, how I witness, is to do the best job possible.
The sport of team surfing will be included in the Olympics for the first time when the world's athletes gather in Tokyo in 2020. As the guy presently coaching the U.S. team, Joey Brand has been hearing about that.
I had some people in the neighborhood about a week ago, they saw me walking the dog, like, hey, you know, it's going to be incredible. You get to walk in the opening ceremonies in Tokyo. And I said, well, Tokyo's 2.5 years away, and I've done enough funerals as a minister to know that I'm not guaranteed tomorrow. So, I don't mean, you know, like, if it happens, great.
Joey Brand says he's just trying to stay in the moment. Good place for a surfer to be, and for a pastor as well, I suppose. Only a Game is produced by Martin Kessler and Gary Wallach with help from Alex Schroeder. Our technical director is Marquise Neal, and our senior producer is Karen Given. Our final word comes from Joey Brand, who, after his pro surfing career was over, was asked to consider a pastoral internship.
I said no, and then I almost drowned in Big Surf on Halloween Day, and then I said yes.
Kind of a message received thing, I guess he's saying. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more sports on Only a Game. Thanks for listening.